Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth takes a closer look at the latest news out of the Trump White House. And then you'll hear a new edition of Late Night Chats with staffers Ellen Waggett and Joe Winarski. Now let's go to Seth.
As Donald Trump nears the 100th day of his presidency, he's celebrating the number of executive orders he's signed and pushing a new plan to cut taxes on corporations. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. This Saturday will mark the 100th day of Trump's presidency, and Trump is desperate for positive accomplishments to celebrate. Yesterday, his White House released a statement bragging that Trump will have signed 30 executive orders during his first 100 days, which is ridiculous. Claiming you've been a good president just because you signed a lot of executive orders makes no sense. But don't just take it from me. Take it from this guy.
We have a president that can't get anybody to do anything, so he signs, you know, executive orders. And country wasn't supposed to be that way.
We have a president that can't get anything done, so he just keeps signing executive orders.
And he goes around signing all these executive orders. It's a basic disaster. You can't do it.
You're supposed to get together and pass a law. He doesn't want to do that because it's too much work. So he doesn't want to work too hard. He wants to go back and play golf.
It's like... It is at this point... Like a law of physics, for every Trump action, there's an equal and opposite Trump clip. I swear, if Trump said the bathroom was down the hall and to the right, I'm sure we'd find an old clip.
Down the hall and to the left.
Damn it! But this is still the best Trump quote about Obama and executive orders.
I want to not use too many executive orders, folks. Because executive orders sort of came about more recently. Nobody ever heard of an executive order. Then all of a sudden Obama, because he couldn't get anybody to agree with him, he starts signing them like they're butter.
Do you sign your butter? Are you one of those guys who puts your name on everything in the fridge? Of course, Trump's previous comments about executive action haven't stopped his supporters like New Jersey Governor Chris Christie from giving him high marks for his first 100 days and specifically citing his executive orders as a reason.
What grade would you give him?
Listen, I'd give him a B so far.
A B?
I would. I'd give him a B. And I would say the reason I give him a B is, first and foremost, because of Neil Gorsuch. I also think some of the things he's done by executive action have been very good on the regulatory side.
I like that Christie thinks he's playing hard to get by giving Trump a B. I'm not giving you an A, Donald. I'm giving you a B. Chase me. Also, I can imagine Trump's reaction to getting a B. That's ridiculous. Everyone knows the highest grade is a C. So Christie likes Trump's executive orders. I wonder what he had to say when President Obama used executive action to get things done.
Now this president wants to act as if he's a king, as if he's a dictator.
The president wants to do things without working with his Congress, without working with the legislature, without getting the consent of the American people.
Dictatorship's not leadership, John.
and he's acting like a dictator and a petulant child.
Yeah. Thank God we no longer have a president who acts like a petulant child.
Quiet, quiet, quiet. Sit down. Sit down. Okay, sit down. A very insulting question. Wait a minute. I don't have to tell you. I don't have to tell you. I'm not going to tell you. I'm just telling you. You know, you're dishonest people.
And I don't want to go to bed. I go to bed when I want to go to bed. And I am having, I'm sorry to say, I am having Skittles for dinner. But Trump isn't the only one who's faced criticism in the first 100 days. There's also his daughter and assistant to the president, Ivanka Trump. There have been a lot of questions about what exactly Ivanka's role is and what makes her qualified for it, as well as her conflicts of interest and connections to her own business. Yesterday, she appeared at a panel in Germany on female business leaders, and instead of lobbing softball questions, the moderator grilled her.
The German audience is not that familiar with the concept of a first daughter. I'd like to ask you, what is your role, and whom are you representing? Your father as the president of the United States, the American people, or your business?
Man, leave it to a German moderator to ask the most cutting questions. Why are you here? What is your purpose? Explain yourself. Also, you are smiling, but I do not think you are happy. Is it a... is it a fake smile? Yes? And then later, Ivanka tried to claim incredibly that her father was actually a champion for families. And again, the moderator followed up with a tough question. Watch Ivanka's face after the moderator jumps in.
He's been a tremendous champion of supporting families and enabling them to thrive in the new reality of
You hear the reaction from the audience, so I need to address one more point. Some attitudes towards women your father has publicly displayed in former times might leave one questioning whether he's such an empowerer for women. How do you relate to that? Or are things changing? Oh, what's your comment on that?
And I notice now that your smile is gone. Is it safe to say that his current dead face is a better indicator of your true feelings? So as Trump approaches the 100-day mark, he's done a total 180 on executive orders, and there are questions swirling about key members of his administration. And then there are the ways in which Trump has just completely backtracked on some of the signature issues of his campaign. Take, for example, NATO, which he repeatedly called obsolete. Now, not only is Trump reversing himself, he's literally pleading ignorance. He told the Associated Press, they had a quote from me that NATO's obsolete. I was on Wolf Blitzer. Very fair interview. So they asked me, Wolf asked me about NATO, and I said two things. NATO's obsolete. Not knowing much about NATO. Now I know a lot about NATO. You see, I'm stupid, so I lied. What's the problem? Why is that problematic? And then, of course, there's the wall. Trump has been locked in a showdown with Republicans in Congress over including money for the wall and a bill to fund the government. And after initially insisting on money for the wall, Trump finally relented and indicated that the border wall funding could wait until September. And that crushed many of Trump's hardcore supporters, like heartbroken Rush Limbaugh, who had to break the news to his audience. Watch how long it takes him to get to that bad news.
I'm not happy to have to pass this on. I'm very, very troubled to have to pass this on. And I want to say at the outset that I hope my interpretation is wrong, and I hope this is not the case, but it looks like, from here, right here, right now, it looks like President Trump is caving on his demand for a measly $1 billion in the budget for his wall.
He sounds like a doctor giving next of kin some terrible news. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you this, but there were complications, and we had to remove your grandmother's wall. And now Mexicans are pouring into her liver. After the disappointed reactions from his hardcore supporters started rolling in, Trump did everything he could to reassure them that the wall would, in fact, be built, although it didn't really seem like he had given the timeline much thought.
The wall gets built. 100%. Thank
when?
You very much.
When, sir? When, sir? When? When, Mr. President? When, Mr. President? When will the wall get built? When will the wall get built?
Soon.
Soon.
Thank you. Behind you.
We're already preparing. We're doing plans. We're doing specifications. We're doing a lot of work on the wall, and the wall gets built.
In your first term?
The wall is very, very important.
In your first term?
Well, it's certainly going to... Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. He's like a dad who made the mistake of mentioning Disneyland to his kids. Are we going, Dad? Are we going? Yeah. Yeah, sure. Why the f*** did I mention Disneyland? from Disneyland. So the president has very little to show for his first 100 days, which may be why Trump, who sold himself as a champion of the forgotten man, is setting his sights on a new goal, a giant tax cut for corporations.
The Trump administration announcing a sweeping tax reform plan, slashing rates for both individuals and businesses across the U.S.
What he says could be the biggest tax cut we've ever had. The tax reform plan will cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 15%.
Who could possibly benefit from such a massive tax cut? Okay, fine, but besides him. Oh, boy! Knew it was coming, and he still... Whew. Now, the details of this plan, which Trump has been working on with his Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, are still very unclear. When he sat down with the AP this week to talk about his first 100 days, Trump tried to offer a preview of the tax plan. But I'm not sure he really helped clarify things all that much. This is the actual transcript from the AP's Oval Office interview with Trump. Notice how many times the reporter who was in the room with Trump could not understand what he was saying. We're going to be doing major tax reform. Here's part of your story. It's going to be a big unintelligible. Everybody's saying, oh, he's delaying. I'm not delaying anything. I'll tell you the other thing is unintelligible. We've been working on it, unintelligible. Secretary Mnuchin is a very talented person, very smart, very successful, unintelligible. We're going to be putting that out on Wednesday or shortly thereafter. Let me leave a little room just in case, unintelligible. Trump's answers are literally just Mad Libs now. I'll tell you about my tax plan. It's going to be a big sandwich. Secretary Mnuchin is a very successful basketball player. Just leave me a little room just in case, China. So Trump is racing to commemorate his 100th day in office by signing a slew of executive orders, pushing tax cuts for corporations, and abandoning his key promises. Donald, do you really think any of this is going to work with voters?
Yeah, sure.
This has been a closer look.
Hi, this is Fred Armisen, the music director of the HG Band. Did you know that Late Night with Seth Meyers has a podcast now? That's what this is. And it's released every Wednesday and Friday. Tell your friends who love Late Night that they should subscribe at iTunes.com/Late Night Seth. You'll find it. What I just said, you'll be able to find it. I believe in you.
Hi, I'm Ellen Waggett. I'm the production designer of Late Night with Seth Meyers.
And I'm Joe Winarski, and I'm the art director.
And this is Late Night Chats with Ellen and Joe. So, Joe, I think one thing that is so interesting about this is that you and I are probably the last two people on Earth who would ever have thought we would have ended up working in television, much less in late night television.
100% agreed.
Right? So I think that's a good way to start, because even 15 years ago, there is zero chance that either of us was going to end up here. And yet, I think we are such an amazing fit for this show and this time slot and these jobs and each other, that it's amazing that we ever thought we wouldn't end up here, because it's a really good place for us both to be. Fair?
Totally. But can I sidetrack and talk about how we met?
Yes.
On the greatest show that that didn't last?
Yes.
I met Ellen 10 years ago?
More.
Oh my gosh, maybe it was 13 years ago. Yeah. I was just out of graduate school. And I got a call from a friend of mine if I was interested in being the props master on a show called Craft Corner Deathmatch.
That is true.
And Ellen Waggett was the production designer.
That is true. And Joe had to deal with all kinds of crazy props on that show. And I had things like mannequin hands holding scissors, and it was a mess. But it was such a fun show.
The TV's talking.
Oh, sorry, someone's talking behind my head.
There we go.
And distracting me. But it was such a fun show. And that's how, although Joe and I had a lot of common friends, and we both started as theater designers, actually. By that point, I had completely moved out of theater, which I did really quickly, because once I actually started working in theater versus working in television, I realized that the big difference for me was that in television, you have money to build exactly what you want. And in theater, at least at that point in my life, there was a lot more dumpster diving and painting things brown and saying they were wood. And I just, once I discovered television, that was it for me. So I had only been working in TV when we finally met. But you were still working in theater a lot.
Yeah.
And you still are today.
I still do some side design for theater, because I can't seem to get away from it.
Right.
But yeah, when I met Ellen, we did a bunch of television together. And then I went away and designed for a bunch of years.
Many years.
And then it was a chance email that has me sitting in this office with Ellen Raggett. So,
because we remained friendly, but we hadn't seen each other in a long time. And Joe emailed me and said, you know, hi, I'm back in town. Let's go out to coffee, which we did. And it was right over by Rock of Ages, which I remember so clearly. And which Joe was working
on. I was the associate on Rock of Ages.
Which she was working on. And we sat at a coffee joint and talked about how maybe she was ready to move back to the city and not be on the road all the time and, you know, maybe come work in television and have a life a little more calm like mine was. And so as it happened, right as she did that, at that point I was still at Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. And one of my art directors there was going on maternity leave. And so it worked out perfectly. And Joe came in and sort of the rest is history. And then Seth Meyers came up and I rolled from one late night to another. And it was perfect because a Joe job opened up so she could stay with me. All right, Joe. So that's kind of how we met and how we ended up here. But I think something that's interesting to people is so many times people say to me, and I bet people say to you too, isn't late night boring because there's not really any design because it's just a set that's sitting there.
Yeah, they're like, so is there what on earth on that
do you
show?
Do? Yeah, is there even a set? Which is, A, it doesn't bother me. I don't care. But B, I think it's so interesting because I've worked in late night now for, I guess, 9 years. And I think they're the most demanding design jobs in many ways that there are because we design everything. And we're constantly designing. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's also, I think the thing that people don't realize too is the speed at which we design stuff. You know, Ellen will do a pencil sketch for something, hand it to me, and I will have it drafted and drawn by that afternoon to give to night crew to build, to load in, to be painted, to be shot 2 days later.
Yeah.
And that is just like a ferocity of it's like that does,
ferocity of design
that doesn't happen like outside of this outside of I don't think you know often outside of this kind of environment.
No, and it's something I mean something that you and I talk about a lot is how that has made us both better designers because you learn to self-edit instantly on a dime
and make decisions as you're drawing.
Yeah,
you know,
and if things go wrong, which they always do. To be able to recover from that and come up with a good solution really, really fast, which you do as any kind of designer. But I think given the positions we're in right now, we've really come to appreciate how finely tuned it is in both of us now. Like when we go off, because we both go off and work on other projects a lot, and you get out in the real world and you realize that not everyone moves at the lightning speed that we're used to working at here. The quality has to be the same. You know, the quality, the way Joe and I work and the way we demand that it looks is not lessened because we're moving so fast, I think. That's one thing I think I'm very proud of at our art department, don't you think, is that we may take shortcuts, but not if it's going to cheapen the look.
Yeah, no, it's always about what the final product looks like.
Right.
I mean, the downtown theater designer in me is always trying to reclaim, reuse, and recycle.
Right.
I'm like, can't we reuse that thing from that other shoot? You know, but that's the only place where I think, like, we have conversations about editing the look.
Yeah, exactly.
Is like, how do we reuse things so that we're not constantly just
churning. And that's an interesting thing to talk about is that we have no, we're here in 30 Rock. Our office is in 30 Rock. Most of what you see on stage is built
in
a teeny tiny room in 30 Rock. And anything else that you don't see on stage is stored in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part of what you and Lauren, I know, manage is,
well,
that. And I mean, talk through your day, because I think your day is fascinating because it is very specific in a way that mine rarely is.
Well, I was going to say, I think the hardest part of what I do is like where to stick stuff, you know, like... You know, for example, we're doing something with a band look coming up, and I had to wait to build it, even though I already knew what it was going to look like, but I had to wait because I had nowhere to put it in between getting it built and painted and it showing up on stage. So I was sitting on drawings because I was like, well, if I paint it, then I have to truck it out to Brooklyn, then it has to get trucked back, and then it's going to get messed up.
And then it has to be repainted.
And this building... Every inch of this building is like little tiny nooks and crannies where we stick stuff. you know? And I have literally begged once, like, can I paint in the elevator bank? Like, I have, like, hunted.
And we've done that.
And we've done it.
Lots of times.
Yeah, because sometimes, like, it doesn't work out spatially, you know, for where I need something painted to go on stage, you know. So I think the hardest part of my job is this endless Tetris I play with, like, can I hide something here for a day since I don't want to send it back out since it's going to go back on camera.
Right.
You know? And,
right.
like, wheeling stuff around the eighth floor.
Right.
You know? And then when Saturday Night Live is here, it becomes an even bigger game because they have all their stuff. And so then there's two shows playing that game on the eighth floor.
And SNL and The Tonight Show and us are all fighting for the same little inches of space in which to do our scenery. And so that's really tough, too. That is a crazy dynamic that we deal with all the time. So that's the hardest part of your job. What's the best part of your job?
Well, you know, I mean, the people I work with, and I don't mean that to be like, oh, I'm on a podcast talking about the show, and I love everyone.
Ellen is my favorite.
And thank God I shared a small office with her. I think we get to work with such wonderful people. You know, it's the nicest staff. You know, and the relationship, you know, with everyone we work with is really, really fun. So I love that about my job. I love, I actually love the speed at which we do things.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying to be like, and moving on, you know, like, you know, that sort of thing.
We built a cave. Now, tomorrow we're going to build a kitchen or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. What about you? What do you think? What's your favorite part? Me.
My favorite part is Joe Winarski, 100%. Second favorite part is the diversity of things that we get to design.
Yeah.
That's really fun. And on these late night shows, I love it that we get to do the remotes as well. So that we're sometimes on location and sometimes in a studio and we're rarely in the same studio and sometimes we're tucking things in our space. And we design such a wide variety of things, inside, outside. That's crazy and fun. And I love so much working with writers. I really, really like that part and helping them make their ideas even better and stronger than they thought they could be, you know? That part is really rewarding for me. And that's one of the things I love about late night is it's a whole host of different writers, each with their own strengths and weaknesses. And that makes it a really good challenge. And I think the other part that I love is that basically you and I spend all day every day solving puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
And they're puzzles that don't necessarily have only one solution, obviously. But you and I both know the instant we've found a really good solution. And I love that feeling when all of a sudden you're like, oh, that was a really good solution for that. That part's really rewarding. And that part continues to get more and more interesting and I get better and better at it, even though I've been doing it for a long time. The flip side is, the part that I hate, is that I have been doing late night for a long time and I have a pretty good, as you can attest to, Joe, I have a pretty excellent meter about whether or not things are actually going to happen.
Ellen is the worst procrastinator in the whole wide world.
It's true.
I'll be like, hey, Ellen, have you thought about that thing? She'll be like, nah. And I'm like, hey, you know, we got to build it. She's like, eh.
And I don't even answer. Like, just doing a good impersonation, I just kind of go, eh. Or I'll say, yeah, I'm doing it, Joe, which is a lie, usually.
She
knows
lies
it.
To me all the time.
But 99% of the time when I'm procrastinating like that, I'm right. And we don't end up doing it.
Yeah, it's true.
It is true. It's very rare.
I can't think of actually an instant where you procrastinate. I can't speak.
Procrastinated.
Where you procrastinated and we actually ended up doing it. What people can't see.
I can think of one, but I'm not going to admit it.
Okay. What people can't see is our office, which is very small, that we built a sister desk. So Ellen and I face each other. Our computers are back to back.
Knee to knee.
So when I start bothering her about stuff, I just lean past my computer and stare directly at her.
And what's so sad is our desk is so tightly packed and so small that I can't even push my monitor over to hide her. So I have to actually face her off quite literally when she wants drawings. Yeah, that part's bad. And I also, by the same token, as that I know, I have a very good sense when things aren't actually going to happen, so I can procrastinate on them. It's sometimes frustrating that we can't push an idea as far as I know it could be pushed. Just because of time or space. Or like, that's a bummer about working in late night when you don't have any space. Probably if you were in a huge studio with a lot of support spaces, that wouldn't be a frustration. But that is a specific problem with working in this building.
It's rare that we have more than 24 hours on a set before it gets shot. Meaning that, once the scenery is put into the actual space in which we're shooting, we generally don't have more than 24 hours to get painters working on it or to do any set dressing on it. So we have to turn ideas around really quickly in the space. And I think that that's what you're talking about, is that we never get that chance to
the final polish on.
Yeah, to pick at something, you know, or that thing where you can, like, look at it on camera and then give your notes to yourself based on what you see
on
camera.
And push it really to the next level.
I mean, we can solve the immediate things we see, but, like, there's never that chance to go back and give it that second pass that you get in theater, which is what makes, you know, that's a big difference there.
And you get in other experience. I mean, I think that's really specific to late night and really specific to here because we can't preset really anything.
Yeah, there's not some big studio lot in which we have several stages to work on.
And, like, an exception to that would be Oscar bait.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a situation where Saturday Night Live was gone. It was a very aggressive script, technically, for the art department, because it was lots of scenery, both in-house and on location. And because Saturday Night Live wasn't here, the way it was scheduled, it was great, because we filled that studio with scenery, and it gave us really the opportunity to develop the sets more than we're usually able to do. So that's a special treat to throw in every now and again. What else? Oh, you know what we should talk about is, because this is a cool thing about working in this building, is that we basically have 24-hour-a-day crews.
Oh, yeah.
NBC is the 30 Rock. There's basically a day crew and a night crew and then a scenic crew. And they all work for us. So when we design something, we immediately give it to the builders. And as you were saying, there's always this 4 o'clock deadline. So 4 o'clock is when the night crew starts. And they're the ones who build 80% of what we do, I would say, here.
Yeah.
And so night crew starts at 4, so we have to have drawings ready at 4 o'clock for them to build at night. And then our scenic crew comes in and they paint it in the morning. And then there's the combo crew, and they're sort of the swing crew, that's the dressing crew. So that's a whole nother part of working in this building that is very specific to this building, because you have to learn how to just manage this 24-hour cycle perfectly. Because if you mess it up, they make it very clear that you have not done it right.
And it's also the game of, like, if I'm under the gun with drafting, like, figuring out how much I can feed night crew.
Right.
So that, like
which three walls can they start on?
Can they start building? And I'll sometimes keep running drawings down to our Eric, who's our show carpenter. I'll run stuff down to him, and then, you know, a couple hours later, I'll find him and I'll give him another drawing, and I'll just keep feeding him drawings.
And you'll literally say, "Just give me 15 minutes,
yeah,
and I'll get this next part done." But you have to go away and give me 15 more minutes too, because on top of all that, we're also
doing a daily show,
managing the day to day, and meeting with the writers and talking about what's coming up, and talking to the segment producers about
do we have a chef
or giveaways or chef. And then there's chefs on the show. And that's a whole nother thing, because we don't really have a kitchen.
No.
They have a kitchen downstairs at the Tonight Show, but we don't have a kitchen really that you can cook anything in. So we have to say to chefs, you can come be a chef on our show, but you can't start cooking till you're in the studio. And that's a bummer. And that's really hard. But we don't do that many chefs here.
And we also deal with things like, when guest bands come in, helping figuring out their layout so that they fit into our tiny, you know, because what I'm sure on air it looks big to people is actually rather small, our studio space.
Yeah.
So we deal with that. And things as we deal with things as simple as when Seth has a picture that he holds up, that goes through the art department. So the sort of variety of little things to Oscar bait or to, you know.
And they all are equally important.
And they're all equally important, and they're all
happening. To the people that they, and even things, I mean, I know that you end up managing things like, when Seth is showing a book, marking the pages and marking what's important. And I mean, all those little specific things what make the show go smoothly.
One of the greatest rituals I have, when talking before about one of my favorite things about the show is Jimmy, who is our studio props head, who's
the best.
He and I have a nightly ritual that we do every night before the show. In the back, backstage, there's a board that has the rundown for the show, and it lists, you know, each guest and what happens with each guest, or if there's a skit or something that has props, and it lists all those things. And Jimmy and I will go through, and I'll be like, okay, so opening the show, you've got the guest book on the desk for the holdup, and then act one, you have so-and-so, and they have two art cards, and then you're doing this thing. And we go through the whole rundown of the show, and then we're done, we look at each other, and we have a secret handshake. And we do it every single night.
Have you ever missed it?
We've never missed it. Once we forgot, and he and I
went running towards each other because we both knew. And all of a sudden, he's like, Joe! And I was like, Jimmy! And we found each other in the hallway. We did the secret handshake in the hallway because it's like, it's this OCD ritual.
Because it's meant to be.
It's meant, you know, because
it has to happen.
The show will not go smoothly if Jamie and I don't do our secret handshake.
God, thank God you did it.
I know. See? It's a.
These would be interesting. Now I'm going to try to like trip you one day and mess you up. You'd be like, Joe, I need you down here in the office right away. I'll see if I can.
No, I have to see Gramsci.
I've got to find Jimmy. I can't leave yet. That's the other part about the show that I love. That's just, it's sort of the whipped cream on the sundae every day is going to mono rehearsal with you.
Yeah.
That's always a fun, and most days, always one of us is there.
Yeah. Most days we go together.
90% we go together and sit together. And it's just a kind of nice breather.
We go
in the middle of the day.
Every day at 4:15, Seth, we do a monologue rehearsal where the jokes and for the monologue and whatever sketches are being done are rehearsed in front of a test audience. And we go as a means of making sure that everyone's happy with whatever props or scenery there are. But even when there isn't props or scenery.
Yeah.
It's just something we do every day.
It's like a nice way to check in with the show and be a part of the whole team. And
yeah.
Be more than just Joe and Ellen
in our hoarder's
cranking
office.
Stuff out in our hoarder's office. Okay, so how do you keep from being bored? Because you and I are both freelancers.
Yes.
That's a clear thing to get across, is that we both still take outside work. We're both at heart freelance artists. So what do you do to keep from being bored by a corporate job, the likes of which neither of us ever thought we would be stuck in? And even though we're happy to be here, it's a very different daily grind than either of us ever saw.
Well, it's funny because when people ask me, like, what's the hardest thing about doing this job, I always say, you know, what's interesting to me is having been a freelance designer for so many years, I was used to, like, being alone in my pajamas, not seeing another human being for 5 days drafting and like, building
Ellen.
Models. And I remember, like, it was really hard for me the first couple of months being like, oh, my gosh, I have to get dressed every day and show up every day.
And we should start having pajama day.
I know. and Ellen, you know, thankfully I sit across from someone so wonderful, you know, otherwise.
We are going to start pajama day, though.
Yeah. And I don't think we've ever had a fight.
We haven't. There's one time Joe got super frustrated at me.
Yeah. But that was it.
But it was only one time.
Yeah.
I think you and I both have a very, in our little tiny space, we have our little bubbles. And we can both, it's crazy. That's what makes it work, is that we can both instantly go in our own little bubble and not hear the other one, not pay attention to the other one, get our work done. Because sometimes I know you'll say something and I won't even.
Like, what?
Wait, what? Were you even talking? Oh,
that's when you're just ignoring
me. What?
Because I want something.
Yeah, now you know I'm just working hard. That's all it is.
But I would say, you know, what keeps being interesting is you keep surprising me. You know, you would think after drawing, you know,
a zillion things
that Ellen's designed over the years, I would be able to predict what she's going to do, and I actually can't.
Right. Sometimes you can.
Sometimes I can. Well, like sometimes
like
I'm
today.
Like, I bet you want the couch here and the table here, and then we're gonna put the.
And I say, brilliant, do that.
Exactly. But like color and texture, and so it's really fun to work across from someone who is always doing something unexpected, or has a different idea about treatment. And I feel like what's great for me is. You know, Ellen has been a mentor to me, you know, in my career, and she's someone that I've looked up to as I've worked for. So that's what keeps the job interesting, is continuing to learn from Ellen in this room, but also watching her other work and things like
and
that.
And you too, Joe. Joe goes off and does these amazing big theater shows, and it's so inspiring. And I always think, that is so inspiring. I don't have that in me at this point in my life. I don't have it's just not part of my existence right now, but I so appreciate it in you, and I so appreciate that you can take time, that this show allows you to have this great theater career is, I think, such a gift, and it makes me very proud that I helped get you in that position where your life is more comfortable as a theater designer than it would be otherwise, and I'm eternally grateful.
This show makes me
the
chillest theater designer, because I'm like, oh,
yeah,
is it going on air tonight? No? All right, then it's going to be fine. We've got previews.
That is true. You do come back all the time, like, oh. Please, you have 2 weeks until there's an audience. They're not going to be here in 4 hours. It's okay.
But
it's made us grow up a lot.
Yeah.
In a good way, I think.
I hope we answered people's.
Think so.
This has been fun.
I hope we've made it sound as good as
it is.
Because it is a great job.
It's a great job. Thanks for chatting, Ellen.
Thank you, Joe. Keep inspiring me every day, and I'll do the same for you, okay?
It's a deal.
All right.
As long as you answer my questions.
Okay. I'll still procrastinate, but I will. But I won't procrastinate on saying thanks for listening, everyone. This has been Late Night Chats with Ellen and Joe.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers?
Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Reyes Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.